we'll see how it goes. So Masse is a really hard one. It's actually interesting. I looked at Rabbi Lam's drashos on, I guess just whatever, his drashos. So he has no drasha for matos. And in the notes, it says, this drasha was actually given Parshas Pinchas, but because it's topically connected to matos also, we've inserted it here. And Masse was not a drasha that he delivered live at the Jewish Center, but rather it was an article he had written for some Jewish periodical. So Matos Masse is not so easy. So I'll leave you with a question, which is not the Chabura, but it's a good question nonetheless. The beginning of Masse, it's not even the topic, but the beginning of Masse has the 42 stops that the Jewish people go on, right? We go from one place to another, right? And what's interesting is that those stops, most of them we've never heard of. And so the question is, why does the Torah, which is not a historical document, why does it spend so much time on all of that when it seems to be not really relevant to what we're, to our psukim and to our context? So that's a good question just to think about during the incredibly long laning this coming Shabbos. But that's actually not the topic I want to discuss. I want to share with you a beautiful idea by Rabbi Sacks on the daughters of Tzlafchad. Rabbi Sacks points out that there's a problem with the story of the Bnos Tzlafchad, and that is that there really are two stories of the Bnos Tzlafchad. We have the story of Parshas Pinchas, which we're, more or less familiar with. The women come and complain, it's not fair, we're going to lose out on our father's inheritance. Okay. And then we have our Parsha, which I think is a little bit less famous. It certainly gets lost more in the, in the summer. And that's the final dealings with the Bnos Tzlafchad. So what I want to try to figure out tonight is, why is the story broken up? It seems a little bit strange that we can't have the story in one straight piece. Meaning, have the Bnos Tzlafchad come, they plead their case. God comes to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, Moshe, you know what? The women are correct. Okay. Accept it. And then go immediately after to the heads of Menashe with their complaints. God saying, they're actually right also. And the plan of how everybody is reconciled, so it's all good. So that's one question that I want to try to figure out tonight. Why is the story divided? The second question is, it seems like if you're going to end Sefer Bamidbar on any note, there is no shortage of really powerful stories in Sefer Bamidbar. Why would you end off with this like anticlimactic story of, okay, you're right, marry this way, fine. Like, why is that's the conclusion of the Sefer when it would seem as though we could possibly end on a higher note? So those are the two questions that I want to try to figure out tonight. We'll learn some psukim, and then a beautiful Ora Chaim, and a fascinating Kli Yakar, and hopefully when it's all done, we'll be able to better appreciate A, the Bnos Tzlafchad, and B, the way this story is set up. Okay, so the Torah tells us like this. Vayikrivu rashei ha'avot l'mishpacha b'nei Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe b'mishpacho b'nei Yosef. Vayedabru l'fnei Moshe v'l'fnei Anasiyim rashei ha'avot l'bnei Yisrael. So the heads of the tribes of the family of Gilad, ben Machir ben Menashe, from the family of Yosef, they come to Vayidabru Livnei Moshe, Livnei Nesiim, Rashei Avot, Livnei Yisrael. And they come and they speak before Moshe and the Nesiim and all the heads of tribes of the Jewish people. Okay, so it is interesting because there Vayikrivu also, and the Bnos Tzlafchad, which we'll see in a little bit, are also Vayikrivu. So what, or Vatikravna, same shorish. Vayomru et Adonit tziva Hashem la'tet et ha'aretz b'nachala b'goral v'nei Yisrael. So they say, you know, listen, God has commanded. God has commanded that we give the Nachla, the Goral of Nesel, to give the land to in a lottery to the Jewish people. And we were told that we had to give Tzlafchad's portion, right, to his daughters. They're going to get married, and if they get married, they couldn't have been, right, presumably they're not that old if all five of them are still single, right? So all of them will get married to people. What's going to happen is the Nachla will be lost from our family, from our tribe. So what's their concern? Their concern is like this. Every Shevet gets their land. Now what happens with the land? The land goes back at the end of his, you know, Yovel, it goes back to the original father that owns the piece of land. So who is this piece of land going to go back to? It's going to go back to its original owner. But the original owner is not going to be the Benot Slavchad. It's going to go to the daughters of Benot Slavchad, the husbands of the Benot Slavchad. So they say, what are we afraid of? We're afraid if they marry out of the tribe, let's say they're all from Menashe, right? Slavchad is from the family of Menashe. If they marry out of the family of Menashe, let's say they marry into, I don't know, Shevet Yehuda. So what's going to happen when they marry into Shevet Yehuda? At the end of, if they do sell their piece of property, or even if they don't sell their piece of property, that land will quickly become attached to Shevet Yehuda instead. So Vim Yah Yovel Vnei Yisrael, interesting, one of the Mefarshim point out, when it says Vim Yah Yovel, if there will be Yovel, what do you mean, if there will be Yovel? Of course there will be Yovel. Yovel happens every 50 years. That was the way of, that's a hint at the fact that Yovel will not last. We're going to lose part of our ancestral land. Okay.
Just a quick question. Each of the five daughters gets one-fifth of that one portion, right?
They get, well, Slavchad gets a portion. I believe they get a fifth of his portion, yes.
So that's what's potentially at risk, I guess, up to five-fifths of maybe, unless he's married with him, Menashe.
Correct. It seems like what would happen is the original owner of the land, it always comes back to them. So it would leave the tribe. Now, the truth is, I guess at some point that's going to happen, that could potentially happen anyway, right? Like,
yeah, you can sell a portion.
Right, you sell your portion, but I'm saying like, let's just play this out. Like, I don't know, 10 generations later, what are the odds that you've gone, you know, Menashe, 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 Menashe every step of the way? In all likelihood, somewhere along the way, you've lost, right? You've married into a different Shevet. So will it always revert back to the original person's land? I don't know. Not 100% sure how that would work. But at least, at the very least, their feeling is, we're going to lose this.
That'd only be if generation after generation, there were never any sons. If there wasn't a son, then that discontinues.
What do you mean? Yeah. You mean it would never? Correct.
Yeah.
You're saying as long as there is a son, it's going to always stay in Shevet Menashe.
I think so, yeah. We're only this situation, right? Where there is no son, are daughters getting the inheritance? If there is a son, then there's no point.
Right. Oh, it's true. Yeah, that's true. So it's going to always be Menashe, and it'll always revert back to Menashe.
That's at least one family, and the other family.
It only works if there's. As long as there is no, it's, you don't have a case where it's all daughters.
Right. Okay, fine. Correct. Okay, yeah. Okay, so what happens? So they're saying, that's their complaint. So Pasuk Hey, Vayitzav Moshe b'nei Yisrael pi Hashem le'emor, Kein mateh b'nei Yosef dovrim. So Moshe speaks to God, And God says to him, "You're right. The Bnei Yosef, right? What the heads of the tribe of Menasseh are saying is actually fair. It is true. If it continues this way, what's going to happen? They're going to lose out." Okay, so that's the argument that they make, and God says, "I agree. This is not a good plan. We got to figure it out." This is what God said to Benot Tzavchad, saying, "You can marry whomever you want, so long as you marry in your tribe." It's like a little bit of a loaded like one there, but anyone, you can marry who you want. They're all good, so long as they're from your shevet. Because it's important that the ancestral lands remain in their tribes. Now this is where Lidoros, this is how we prevent it from being a problem, as like Greg and Steve were saying. How do we ensure that it never leaves the tribe? So if a girl is inheriting from her father, she then has to make, because there are no sons, she has to make sure that she does what? She has to make sure that she marries within her tribe. Because the land should stay in the tribes that they belong to. It's got to stay like this. And the Benot Slavcha do exactly as they were commanded, which is, you know, wonderful. They all marry in their tribe. They get married, but all in their tribe. They go out and marry their uncles. This way they keep it really in.
And so the end result of this is that Slavcha actually completely loses his machla. Menashe keeps whole, but Slavchad has no portion now. The men that they married, it becomes part of their family's ancestral land at all time and forever.
And
we're only concerned about the wholeness of the tribe at the highest level, not the family levels. That's what this plan does. Which, okay,
I don't know. Let's see. Let's try to figure this out. The Benos Slavchad, so their land, it's going to pass on to their children, right?
And the child, it's two people, a guy from Menashe, and
right.
Benos Slavchad get married. Now that they have children, so if they have boys, I mean. So how is Slavchad connected to it?
So
live on the land? I mean, what's the notion of having a nafla? I don't actually understand
Right. So it's a little bit complicated, because normally the way nachla works is like you live, you die, you pass on your stuff to your next generation, right? So let's say if you were talking like strict like halachic law, you own a piece of land in Israel. Your daughters don't really matter, right? It's, you know, for what it's worth, your son is going to inherit it. You have no sons. Okay, so then there's rules in place. I think the complicated piece here is that because they hadn't even gone into the land itself yet, there were rules that Slavchad, even though he's dead, he's one of the people that left Egypt, so he gets a portion of land, which would be called like Slavchad's land. So in that one generation, the generation that's coming into the land of Israel, yes, their husband would have a piece of their own land. Slavchad would have his own portion. I guess to a certain extent, when it's inherited by the future generation after their husbands pass away, yeah, there's going to be a sort of murkiness and a merging of the property. But Slavchad's legacy, so to speak, lives on because that was his piece that went into the land of Israel. Lemaisa, all that matters is that, like you said, David, that it stays in the family. Because in 20 generations, nobody cares anymore that it's Slavchad's field. Nobody cares that it's Slavchad's uncle, brother's field. Nobody cares anymore whose it is. But it'd be really weird if you have, like, a piece of land in Shevet Menashe that doesn't belong to Shevet Menashe. Now, that doesn't mean that
it's going to happen.
It's
going to happen to all properties. All the Shvatim are going to have the same intermarriage problem.
No, but that's right. But the point that was made was that, and the Torah is telling us, and that's, I forgot that, that's what Stephen Gregor is saying, that you, it doesn't work that way. Meaning, if you have a piece of land, it does stay in the Shevet. Now, let's say I'm from Shevet, whatever, and I sell my land because I financially can't afford it anymore. That piece of land no longer belongs to me, but at Yovel, what happens with that land? It reverts back to my Shevet. But let's say if a person only has daughters, then what would happen is those daughters would have to marry within the Shevet. Because otherwise, then that's what would happen in every generation.
Well, not only that, they'd have to marry before they even got to Israel because they would have no property.
Who, these girls?
Yeah.
Why would they?
We have nowhere to live because we have nowhere to inherit from.
No, well, they'd still get the property. Meaning, let's say four of them got married, and the fifth one never got married, right?
Right.
So, like, we're creating, like, a real, like, Yevamos case, like, one of these, like, theoretical situations. So, okay, so you have one girl that never marries. She still gets a piece of property. That's, the halacha is that the girl gets a piece of property. The only thing is that should she marry, which presumably she will want to, should she marry, she has to marry within her tribe. If she doesn't marry, then when she dies, that portion of land is going to revert back to the nearest relative, which might be a sister or a brother-in-law.
Right. No, what I'm saying is, at this specific time that they're asking about this, I'm saying, when we go in Eretz Yisrael, we have no land to live on until we are married. We should be able to. That, I think that's what the argument is. I think the argument is my family should have the ability to have land also, even though we don't have a brother.
Well,
and Hashem says okay.
Right. No. I think that. Well, I think I think their argument is slightly different, unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. I think what their argument is that our dad died. And he is entitled to land. Now, we don't care if we get it or if someone else gets it, but it has to somehow be attached to our father. So how does that work? Either of two things is going to have to happen. Either we get the land, in which case, as daughters, we count, or tell our mother that she needs to do yibum with one of our uncles. Because if we don't count, then it's as though she has no children. And if she has no children, then she has to marry one of them until she has a son so that the son will perpetuate the memory of our father. I think that's really where they're coming from. I don't think they care per se about land, but they don't want Slavchad to lose out in the inheritance. Okay, so that's how it ends. They marry their uncles. So it's all good. Everything stays in the family. These are the mitzvos, the chukim and the mishpatim, or just the mishpatim, that are commanded by God to Moshe by Arvos Moav on the edge of the Jordan River. Now, interestingly, is that we have a similar pasuk at the end of Vayikra, where these are all the mitzvos, blah, blah, blah. But it seems to be that this is a great mitzvah to end Sefer Bamidbar, which is essentially the end of the story of the Torah. But why are we ending with this story? That's our question that we have to try to figure out. Now, just an interesting point. It seems like Moshe was not equipped the same way he wasn't equipped for last time's question. Does not seem like he was equipped for this one either. Which is a little bit interesting. Okay, let's skip to the second page. We're going to go back to Parshas Pinchas and take a look at another, the first story. And then afterwards, we'll take a look at the Or HaChaim and the Kli Yakar. So, Vatikravna b'dot Slavchad ben Chefer ben Gilab ben Machir ben Menashel mishpachot Menashe ben Yosef. So, the daughters of Tzlafchad ben Chefer ben Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe, who were from the families of Menashe ben Yosef, and these were their names, Machla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, Vetirza. These five girls, whose names are now in a different order than they are at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. Rashi does point that out as well. Just, I always like putting this out there, although some of you might already know this from hearing this from me before, but my favorite Chidon HaTanach question of all time, before Chidon HaTanach went multiple choice, which made the test a whole lot easier, but until I was in sixth grade, the final Chidon HaTanach was actually seventh grade, I don't remember which one, it was like just fill-in questions. So great fill-in question for Sefer Melachim and Bamidbar. It was a cross-reference, a name of a person and a city that are the same. So it's Tirza. Tirza is the capital, the original capital of Malchus Yisrael. And it's also the daughter here. It's just a good trivia fact that I always love to share with people. I got that question, by the way, totally wrong. I left it blank. I had no idea, but I haven't forgotten it. So they approach Moshe, Elazar, and the Nesiim, and everybody by the Olmo, and they say, "Avinu mei pamidbar, our dad died. He was not part of Adas Korach. Now, why is that important? Because if he was part of Adas Korach, he would have lost his nachla." He ain't lo right, but ki becheto mate. He died from his own sin. Uvanim lo hayulo. He didn't have sins. He didn't have sons. He did have sins. So what were his sins? So the Medrash tells us two possibilities. Either he was the mekoshesh, or which was the person that collected wood on Shabbos. He was mechal Shabbos on purpose, bifar hesya, making the point of showing everybody that if you mechal Shabbos, the punishment is bad. Or, alternatively, he was one of the Mapilim. He was one of the people that try to go up into the land of Israel after God says, you're not allowed to go up into the land of Israel after the Meraglim. Now, to me, I actually like that answer a little bit more. Does it really matter? It doesn't. But there is a consistency in personality between Tzlafchad and his daughters, meaning he was one of those people. We don't know that every single person cried out and said, oh, we don't want to go into the land of Israel, it's terrible, but the overwhelming consensus was we don't want to go into the land of Israel. The Mapilim were misguided because God said don't do it, and they did it. That's their mistake. But I think that the important point would be if he was one of the Mapilim, it means that he did love Israel. Not everybody ran up against God and tried to go into the land of Israel, but these people said no! We're Zionists, and we have to go to the land of Israel. Therefore, we're going to go up. And God says, I'm sorry, you're not going to make it, and they die. So they say that our father died. Lama yigara shem avinu mitoch mishpachto ki ein lo bein. Why should our father lose out? Because he has no son. Tunulanu achuza b'toch achei avinu. We want to inherit with our father, his brothers. Vayikrev Moshe mishpatam lefnei Hashem. Moshe takes the question to God, which takes a great amount of humility, right? Five women, which back then, for five women, we'll see in the Or HaChaim, it's an interesting explanation he gives, but for five women to approach Moshe Rabbeinu in such a public way is a really big deal, and Moshe could, like, I don't know, he could daven it up, right? You know, make up an answer. No, he says, no, it's a good question, I have no idea, let's go to God. God says to Moshe, saying, "Kain benot slavchad dovrot." What they're saying is spot on. Naton titen lam achuzat nachala b'toch achevihen. They should inherit with the brothers of their father. Vavarta nachlat avihen lahen, and then the nachla of their father will be transferred over to them. And speak to the Jewish people, saying, "Ish kiamut vein einlo. If a person dies and has no sons, so his nachla is passed on to his daughter. If he has no daughter, If there is no daughter, I mean, a guy dies with no kids, so then the inheritance goes to his brothers. V'im ein lo achim, he's an only child with no children. U'netatem enachlato l'achei aviv. Then it goes back to his uncles, right? Okay, so let's make sure we got that. If a guy dies and has no sons, it goes to his daughters. If a guy dies and has no children, it goes to his brothers. V'im ein achim, what if he has no brothers? He's an only child, and his father is an only child. U'netatem enachlato
l'shem. And he
has no uncles. Sorry, let me do that one more time. If he has no kids, it goes to his uncles. If he has no uncles because his father is also an only child, that's Pasuk Yud Aleph. U'netatem et nachlato l'sheiro akarov ilav mimishpachto. It goes to his nearest relative. So whoever that would be. V'yarashota, and he inherits it. And this is the law that stuck. Okay? So that's...
Had the notion, the laws of Nachla been given prior, but they were given incomplete? No.
So let's take...
Clearly there's a message being delivered here, like you said before, for five girls to approach Moshe in front of all the elders and for the whole nation to bring this question up to catch him, you know, not mean spirited, but to ask, and Moshe acknowledges the greatness of the question. Why didn't Hashem give these laws 5 minutes before or some other time he could have selected to, so that this question wouldn't have been raised in this fashion? Clearly, it was raised in this fashion intentionally.
Unless this is different than the regular laws of Nachla. Does this apply?
I'm saying, have laws of Nachla been given in the Torah before this?
So they were.
And were they different than this?
No, this is what happens. I'm happy that you asked that question. It's a good one. And you also gave me a second to like grab my Tanakh and take a look. So that is Perechav Zayin Pasuk Aleph. If you look at Perechav Vav, which is not in the Makoros, Perechav Vav Pasuk Nun Bet. So this is after we counted all the Jewish people. So it says, "Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe le'emor la'eila teichalei ka'aretz benachala b'mispar shemot." These people that were just counted are going to get Nachla based on their names. La'rav tar benachlato v'la'mata minachlato. Each, it'll be based on numbers. So if you have a tribe that's big, they'll get a bigger portion. If you have a tribe that's small, they'll get a smaller portion. Everybody will get what they want. That's why it's interesting. Yosef, right, gets a double nachla, so to speak, right? What's his double nachla? His double nachla is that Ephraim and Manasseh count as two separate shvatim, right? But what would have happened if Ephraim and Manasseh had been one shevet? They would have gotten like 76,000 pieces in the land of Israel. Because that's how big Ephraim and Manasseh were in there, about 76,000 people. Instead, what happens? Ephraim gets, I don't know, Manasseh gets whatever, it's like 40 and 36. So they still get the same 76,000 pieces. He doesn't really get a double Nachla. His only claim to fame is that his Shevet is two, as you know, two names as opposed to one. But basically, David, when it's all said and done, God says, "Ish lof kudav yutan achlato." You're going to get it based on your numbers. And then, "Ach begoral yechalek et haaretz." You're going to divide it by goral. L'shmot matot avotam yinchalu, based on the names of the heads of the tribes and the fathers of the nation. Al pia goral or the shvatim. Al pia goral techalek nachto bin rav lemaat. So I think that after that, what?
So. Now, Ephraim and Manasseh would not get 76,000. Only the firstborn would get the Nachala.
No. Anybody that was counted. I think there's two ways that there's. I never really fully understood this, but there's two people that get land in Israel. If you were Yotzei Mitzrayim, all those men get it. And then the people that were counted at the end of Pinchas, 40 years later. and somehow it's reconciled. Meaning, it's not like if you were in, let's say you were, obviously if you were a Yotzei Mitzrayim anyway, you're not going to be able, if you were counted as a Yotzei Mitzrayim, that means that you were 20 and above and not from Shevet Levi, which means automatically that unless your name is Kalev or Yoshua, you're not going into the land of Israel, right? So there was like a reconciliation of the numbers somehow, where the dead and the live, their numbers merge and re-split. But Ephraim and Manasseh had 76,000 men. Let's assume the numbers were more or less the same 76,000, as opposed to in Shimon, where the numbers like decreased substantially from the beginning of the time in the desert until the end of the time of the time in the desert. So they would have gotten 76,000. Instead, they get 40 and 36.
Yeah, Henry, it's the same as saying Yosef got 76,000 or Ephraim and Manasseh, Ephraim plus Manasseh got 76,000.
Right.
It's not the number of generations from the 12 brothers.
Right. So that's why I always find that interesting. But anyway. Okay. So
wait, you just reread the Perchof Vav, and so that this new set of laws is different from that?
No,
it didn't say.
Well, it wasn't clear, meaning it said that all these people are going to get a portion in the land of Israel. So that's where that's where the girls are like, wait, hold on a second. Our dad should be eligible.
So my question remains, why, and you don't have to know, you don't know, as much as you know, you don't know anything that God knows, and that's not a disparagement. Why didn't Hashem give all the rules in Chavav so that B'nos Lavka would not have to approach Moshe in front of everybody the way that they did to make this public proclamation, which was clearly an intentional act by Hashem having these girls play their role?
Okay, so...
Yeah, please.
Their question is actually not about Yerusha. Their question is, our father's not here... We want to preserve his name. Give us a port. We need dividing portions. Give us our father's portion, rules of Yerusha and something that may have gone unexplored before by Hashem, or specified. They're saying give us a piece, just like everybody else, so we're in line with everybody else. And then it kind of devolves pretty quickly, which you can see makes sense. Why? He said, all right, now that we have this in place. You're raising questions. If someone dies and he only has daughters, then it goes into this new set. But the answers about the Yerusha is not really an answer to that question. Hashem said, give them an Achuzah. It's not a Yerusha.
Okay, so right. But I think what David's question is, like, God knows that they're... I mean, first of all, we don't know...
I get the question.
Right, I think that it's fair to say that, just statistically, there's 600,000+ men. The likelihood that the Benos Tzlafchot are the only family that this applies to is pretty small, right? There have to be other cases of this. So why is it that God didn't just say, like, let me give it all out on the table, you'll all understand where I'm going with this, and we'll be fine. So, David, again, I appreciated that there was conversation because it gave me a chance to be... a little bit rude and look in the Chumash at the same time. So here we go. Rashi actually answers that question in Pasuk Hey. He says, "Vayikrev Moshe Mishpatan." So he says like this: "Nit alma halachu mimenu v'kan nifral shonitala tara lomar v'adavar sherikshem ikem takrivu elai." Rashi gives two answers, which means he's clearly not 100% comfortable with either one of them. The first one was Moshe, when he appointed the judges, said, "Listen, guys, here's the deal. If there is ever something that you don't know, it's too hard for you, come to me." Rashi says that was arrogance. So his punishment is that here, these five women come in front of him, ask him a question, and they stump him. Right? That answer would never fly like nowadays. But Rashi wrote this comment somewhere in the, late thousands, early 1100. He was able
to... He died in 1105, so...
Right, so let's assume right before that. So it's somewhere between like 1060 and, and 1100. He could get away with that. That's one answer. But the other answer that he says is, "Davar acher, ru'uya hayta parsha zu likateva yidei Moshe, ela shezachu b'mnot slavcha v'nichtval yadan." I think Rashi's second answer is that this was going to have to be an answer that was going to come up into the Torah. It was going to be addressed no matter what, and Moshe himself should have been zochet to ask to write the halacha. It should have been a vayedaber Hashem al Moshe le'mor. God spoke to Moshe and said, this is the law of nachla when you only have daughters. The same way we have the halachos of yibum and things like that. So then why isn't that written that way? Because the benos tzlafcha cared the way they did, God gives them the credit for it. So that's the second answer. Okay.
That's pretty high praise for them, because, right, like a yibum situation could have happened, and they could have had this woman come along and say, what do I do now? And they could have answered it like this, but that's pretty high praise for them to get this credit for inventing a circumstance and then having Moshe take the question to Hashem and getting an answer. That's pretty impressive. All right, it's nice.
Yeah. Okay, so those are the two answers to your question. At least according to Rashi, there might be more. Okay, so we still are stuck with our two questions from the beginning. Why divide the story of Vinod Slavchid into two? That's the first question. And the second question is, why is this the end of Bamidbar? So I want to share with you a beautiful answer by Rabbi Sacks. So Rabbi Sacks says that Bamidbar is actually a book about individuals. If you really think about it, what's the very beginning of Bamidbar? It's, we're going to count the number of people in the Jewish people. Why do we need to count the number of people in the Jewish people? The purpose of counting, it's a nice idea, is that everybody counts. Right? Sometimes when there's so many people, the feeling is, I don't matter. But when there are only a few people...
I was going to say it, Jewish lives matter, okay.
So anyway, but that I think that that's like a very Jewish concept. That the individual does matter, meaning we're not just swept away in the general feeling of community, but the individual has a place within the community. And that's the very important message of Sefer Bamidbar. And Sefer Bamidbar is full of individuals. We do have a lot of people in there that make a difference. Bein letov, bein lera. I mean, if you go back to the beginning, you get named people. Right, we have Eldad and Medad. You have the Miraglim. You have Korach, Dasan, Aviram, and the Benos Slavchad. What the Torah is telling us is that you matter. You really, really do. And comes along the Benos Slavchad, and what do they say? They say, we're defending our rights as individuals. It would not be right for the community and the community's needs and the idea of Nachla by Shevet to forget about the fact that we exist as individuals and we have our rights. That's the idea that Rabbi Sacks begins to develop. If you take a look at the Kliyakar has an amazing, amazing comment. It's one of several comments on the Pasuk, Shlach Lecha Anashim. Why does it say Shlach Lecha Anashim? Was there even a Havamina in our minds that the spies were going to be women? Of course the spies are going to be men. So he gives a lot of different answers, but this one is a beautiful one. Lefisha amar chazal hanashim ayu sonim et ha'aretz. The men in the desert hated the land. V'amru nitna rosh v'nashuva mitzrayma. They said, let's go back to Egypt. V'hanashim ayu mechav avot ha'aretz. It was the women who loved the land. V'amru, and they said, t'na lanu achuza. It's the Benos Slavcha that say, give us the land. V'al karcha hamar kodesh baruch hu l'fi dati shani ro'at b'atid haya yoter tov l'shloach nashim. God says, you should not send male spies. Right? Kliyaka wrote this in the 1500s. Which should not have been male spies. It should have been females. Why? Because they love the land. Ki lo yisapru b'gnuta. They're not going to see the negative of the land. Aval lecha, shlach lecha, Hashem, Moshe Rabbeinu, in your perspective, you're going to send men. L'datcha shatah savur shaksheirim heima. You think that the men are okay. V'atah savur sha'aretz chaviv aleim. You think they like the land. Tishlach Hashem, you send men. V'zehu shlach lecha l'datcha Hashem. Aval l'dati haya yoter tov l'shloach Hashem ka'amur. But God says, I would have rather sent 12 women spies. This is an unbelievable Kliyakar. If I had seen this Kliyakar, Parshat Shlach, We would have done the whole chabura around this idea that God wanted women spies, not male spies. But what the Kliyakar's message is that women were just model citizens in the desert. If you had sent spies that were women, there would have been no sin. These women, specifically the Benos Slavchad, who are the carriers of the banner of women's rights in the desert, are saying that women are better suited for these types of decisions than the men are. They're more clear, their thoughts are clearer, and certainly their thoughts are purer. That's as the Kliyakar is the message of Shlach Lecha Nashim. But I think what Rabbi Sachs's point is that if the book is all about individuals, you have to look at these individuals and say, there are some people that really have an ability to see the things in the right perspective, and clearly he feels that that is women in this case. Let's take a look at the Or HaChaim. Got to flip back to page 1. Because the Or HaChaim, I think, takes the Benos Slavchad and builds them up even more. And then, I think once we have that, I think we could possibly answer some of our questions. The Or HaChaim says like this, Vatikravna benot slavchad. So Omro Vatikravna, it says that they came close. It doesn't say that they stood there. Shamar b'samuch. Lomar shalom amdu lefnei Moshe. They did not come straight to Moshe. Ad shehid va'adu yachad be'etz aguna. Until they had like really thought their ideas out. Ve'u ki yesh b'piyam nechona b'ta'ana ha'nishmat kasher eva'er b'ezrat Hashem. V'achar kach amdu lefnei Moshe. The Vatikravna is a very slow approach. They think it out. They wonder. They're not sure. And then they conclude, you know what? This actually is true. Our point is a valid one. How often is it that people's biggest mistake is they don't think. And then they jump to conclusions and they're like, oh, we got it. Right? My idea is amazing. But maybe their idea is not so amazing. The Benos Slavchad Vatikravna, they slowly approached. But what happens? More than that, Vatikravna l'mishpecho ben Asher ben Yosei perish nidvadu l'kachat eitza megdoli yeshevi l'meleich alei mishum derech eretz. First they went to speak to the gedolei hashevet. They spoke to the leaders of their tribe. V'ulai sheramaz ha-katuv be'umro benot lomar she'aratam ha'itama ha-shamar b'samuch ish l'viv gudav. They go slowly. They were embarrassed. First they spoke to the Shvatim. After they had gone there, they weren't quite as embarrassed anymore, and then they went to Moshe. A possibility is that they slowly worked up their ranks. I guess the modern day equivalent would be, you don't go straight to the Supreme Court. What do you have to do? You start with the lower courts, and you work your way up until finally you go to the highest court in the land. That says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh is what they're doing. They slowly go up. Rabbi Riskin, though, I saw this years ago, has such an amazing spin on this. He says, do you know what a credit that is? Do you know how exhausting it is to go through the judicial system in general? But imagine being a woman going through a judicial system that does not have a place at the time really for women. The women go to the lower courts. And the lower courts hear and say, I don't know. They have this sense of righteousness that their cause is just. Vatikravna, maybe that's how Rabbi Riskin would read the pasuk. They go slowly through the process. But because they believe they're correct, they don't stop, despite the fact that there are all these obstacles in their way until they get to Moshe Rabbeinu. The Orachayim, the Kliyakar, build up the Benos Slavchad as not only model citizens, but women that were willing to really, really, really sacrifice, put themselves out, embarrass themselves, until they get to finally be in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah is telling us in Bamidbar that the Yachid matters. The individual does matter. But here is the key piece. So does the Tzibur. See, all too often, in the ideologies and the isms that come up in the world, it's either or. Either you have that the community matters, and the individual is totally lost, communism, or you have the exact opposite, where the individual matters so much that the greater good doesn't matter. Says Rabbi Sachs, the Yachid matters, but so does the Tzibur. The B'nai Menashe have a valid point, and it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be validated. That's where our Parsha is, and that's really where our Sefer is. And he says that if you look carefully at the structure of Sefer Bamidbar, until Parshas Pinchas, about that point, it's mainly about the individual. Then maybe you go into the Korbanos, which are Korbanos Tzibur. And then when you come into Sefer Parshas Matos Maseh, you come into more communal functions. The communal function of the Arei Miklat. The communal function of the way Nachla is given. And at the very end, the B'nai Menashe's point that our Shevet does really matter. What God is trying to do is God is trying to create a society for the Jewish people that both the individual has rights, but the individual is beholden to the congregation. The congregation, though, is not so strong that the individual loses his individuality. Bamidbar ends with Inyanei Tzibur in such a way to remind us that while Yechidim, individuals, matter, they only matter if they are part of the community. I think it's an amazing approach that answers our question. Why divide the story of Benos Slavchad in two? It has to be done that way. It has to take us in Pinchas and show us these women, they do matter. But at the same time, it has to bring us back to our parsha at the very end and wrap up by saying, but the Tzibur also matters. That's why the parsha is the end of. This is why it's the very end of Bamidbar. I would argue it's not anticlimactic, but the opposite. It signs, seals, and cements the notion of what Bamidbar is trying to do. It's trying to tell us that every piece, both individuals and the congregation, all matter. But for it to work, they have to go in perfect concert with each other, and that's how it ends. With that in mind, then Eila Mitzvos HaMishpatim, the entire essence of the mitzvos and the entire essence of the Mishpatim and the Torah are to protect both the individual and the Tzibur. And that is what happened by Arvos Moav as they're about to go into the land of Israel. That's a very, very, very powerful idea that I believe Judaism has done a really good job of bringing to light and making it as part of the world and the community for thousands and thousands of years.